Welcome back to the Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Eastrick.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
This is episode number 5, entitled The Big Free.
The Big Free.
Now, you might have heard of Big Oil, or Big Paper, or Big Media, or what else?
Big
what else
Government.
Big Government, right? But you may never have heard about Big Free.
Big Free is the biggest of all those bigs.
Yeah. Well, exactly, right? Because Big Free could take over the world.
I think Big Free already is taking over
the world. It already is taking over the
world. So what do we mean by Big Free?
Well, that's the real question, okay? So the Big Free is the internet in general, right? So the internet is destroying all sorts of things by giving things away for free. So it starts with Google giving away searches for free. Right, but then Google News comes along and starts giving away news for free, and all these hundreds of newspapers around the country are really mad that Google is giving away their stories for free and giving away AP content for free, which all of them are publishing in their newspapers.
Right.
And you know what happened over the past 15 years? Hundreds and hundreds of newspapers folded. Hundreds. All across the United States. Because the content that people used to pay them money to get is being given away. Craigslist is another great example. The reason that most newspapers have closed is because of Craigslist. It's not because of Google.
The classified income.
Because their biggest source of income was classified ads. And when Craigslist gives away classified ads for free, anybody can put one up, anyone can read one, then we don't need the local newspaper anymore, right?
And not for classifieds.
And the local newspaper dies.
Right. And then, but then what's interesting, though, is that the internet and the tools that the Big Free kind of put out there have actually allowed small town newspapers that have embraced it to do more than they ever could before and actually create kind of niche content that a lot of them have gone to a heavily online edition. But I can read the paper from my hometown.
All right.
Back
okay.
in Missouri.
True. Okay, but let's get a few more examples of the Big Free out there. I think one of the biggest, bestest examples of the Big Free is Google Books.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Millions and millions of books online for free that you can read. Okay, now granted they're all pre-1923, which is when the Google lawyers or whoever decided that was the safe date that wasn't covered by the current copyright law or whatever. So Google Books is out there. The Internet Archive, archive.org, another great site, tons and tons of free books and content, video, audio, pictures, all kinds of stuff. What are some other great examples?
But when you talk about Google Books, you have to talk about the big nearly free, which are things like heavily discounted Kindle with Amazon.
Well, okay, Kindle's a great example, right? Because even on Kindle, right, you can get tons of public domain books pre-1923 for free to read on your Kindle device or to just read on the Amazon website.
Or if you have Prime, I have Prime,
right?
You can borrow books and read them. You basically have a digital library without having to go to the library.
Okay, other examples of Big Free. There's a great website called LibriVox.org,
yeah,
which has audiobooks for free. So people tons around the world record these audiobooks and post them up there as MP3 files for free. You can download them and listen to things like Charles Dickens or Nathaniel Hawthorne or the Bible or whatever online for free.
Right, and then let's look at Hotmail comes along.
Sure.
Before that, you had to pay $19.99 for AOL.
Exactly, you had to pay for email.
And then Hotmail comes along and it starts giving away email. And now who would think about paying for email? Gmail, obviously. Well, Google's the giant gorilla in the room, obviously. I mean, Gmail, I mean, you can get an entire suite of tools.
Right, well
email, everything they used to with Microsoft Office, all this stuff for free with a Google account.
Right.
And the question
is, so you don't need Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, all those things, right? Because you can have all those Google Docs, right, that will do all the same functions.
Now, but here's the problem, is that there is no free lunch, and the Big Free isn't free.
Right, right. Okay, so let's talk about examples of the Big Free coming back to bite.
Right, so for starters, long before we knew the NSA was spying on us, we knew that Google was spying on us because they were strangely good at putting the right ads on the side of our email.
Right, or Amazon.
Or Amazon, because they were... But Amazon, you're kind of opting in because you're purchasing things and they're basing it on your purchase and searches.
Whereas Google's just reading your email.
Google's reading your email. Well, a robot
is
looking for words in your email.
Right.
And then offering you things based on a probability. And that's like, okay, well, that kind of makes me nervous. But at the same time, so you can't really gripe about it.
Okay, let me give you a few really specific examples of the big free coming back to bite. So Google started this free service, right? All of Google services are free for the most part, called Goog 411. This is right around maybe 2003, 2004. And it was a voice search service. You could call Goog 411 in any area code across the country, and it would say, hey, this is Google, and you would tell it what you were looking for. So say, for example, you're looking for a particular restaurant. So you tell it the name of the restaurant, and then it spits back to you the address or whatever of that restaurant, and then it says, do you want me to connect you? And it would literally connect your call to whatever place you were interested in finding. That was a great service, and it was free. And 411 service, real 411 service, is really expensive.
It's stupid expensive.
It's incredibly expensive. It's like $5 a minute or whatever. And then, I think it was in 2011 or 2012, Google just shut off Goog 411. Just said, well, we're just not going to do this anymore. Goodbye.
I tell you one thing.
Just cut it off.
I mean, think about this.
So they could have put people out of business who were doing the same kind of service, and they were, because they were giving it away, and then they just kill it.
Right. And, like, Google Voice, for instance. I love Google Voice. I use it. And that was literally before Google Voice bought them out. It's like called Grand Junction or Grand Station or something like that. There was a company that developed that, and they bought them out and then started giving it away for free. And I can put $25-$30 on my Google Voice account with my credit card and call just about anywhere in the world for like a penny a minute.
Right.
And talk to whoever I want. I'm old enough to remember being a little kid in the 70s. And in long distance, my gosh, you go, quick, come here, say hi to your grandma.
Right, yeah, because it's like $4
a minute.
Honey,
come here,
yeah.
It's a long distance call.
Right.
You know, because you're paying, I mean, the money is racking up.
Yeah,
hey, how's it going? I got a puppy. I want my ball game. Bye.
Right.
And you hand it to the sister because you can't talk. Now we don't have everyone I know has borderline unlimited minutes on their phone.
Let me just give you a couple scary examples of what could happen with Big Free. So let's just say all of a sudden Google realizes, you know, YouTube, we've had it for about 10 years now, and well, we really haven't been able to turn a profit with it, so we're just going to turn it off.
Right.
And they just delete YouTube. Can you imagine? There are like millions upon millions and millions of videos in there. All gone, right?
But, you know, but here's the other good thing about Big Free. Is that almost every video on YouTube that's worth looking at is in three or four places on the internet.
Hopefully, right?
I mean, right now, if you just go look up...
Okay, but what if they just decided to turn off Gmail?
Oh, now that is a whole different
ballgame. Right? They could just say, you know what? Gmail isn't profitable anymore. We're just going to turn it off. Click.
I mean...
the people would be outraged.
Now, you have...
But...
You have records of them doing this with Google Notebook and Google Wave.
And Goog 411.
And they... But with Google Notebook and Google Wave, they were really careful to broadcast it and warn you again, and then warn you that it was coming up, and warn you. And even when I didn't do anything, because I had just played with Google Notebook, I tried it out as a possible solution for implementing getting things done system. And so I had a bunch of files set up in it, but I didn't really use them for much. They ended up making all of my notes into Google Docs and putting them into my Google Docs.
Yeah, but that was just, they just did that because they were nice. Right, they don't have to do that. They're not contractually obligated to do that.
They don't owe us anything.
I mean, with Gmail, this is what's so scary, right? You've got millions and millions of people who depend on Gmail every day and use it constantly. They could turn it off in the blink of an eye, and all of those people could lose all of their email and have nobody to complain to because they didn't have any contractual obligations, right?
Right.
Google doesn't owe them anything. They've never paid Google any money, and yet they're so dependent on Google.
Now, I think the people that have... like enterprise, where you're paying $50 a year to have the business version of Google or whatever.
Sure,
there's probably a contractual.
Those people have more of a contractual.
They would probably have
agreement.
To like give you some time to. But yeah, I mean, if I woke up tomorrow and Gmail was gone, I have like 15 email addresses for so many projects I have and stuff. They all funnel to one Gmail address. They're all through Google for the most part, It's like, oh my gosh, if I woke up tomorrow and they just shut Gmail off,
okay,
I would be screwed. Let me give you, in a big way.
Let me give you another example.
It would be bad. It would be really
big
bad.
Big free coming back to bite. So I don't know if you've ever used one of those file syncing services or automatic backup services
online. Yeah.
So I was using
Carbonite or something like that.
Yeah, I was using this one called SugarSync.
Yeah.
They give you like 5 gigabytes for free or 7 gigabytes or whatever. And so I've been using this for 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. And then in late November, mm-hmm. I got an email from SugarSync saying, we're discontinuing our free service. You can upgrade to this account that costs like $50 a year, or we will just delete all of your stuff on this day. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, fortunately, I was able to switch everything over very quickly to a different free service. Mm-hmm. But it's just the fact that if I hadn't been paying attention, or if that email had gone to my spam folder or whatever, they literally could have deleted hundreds and hundreds of files that were very important to me.
Right. Well, there's a question. We've gotten kind of used to having things in one place. You kind of have to have maybe Dropbox and SugarSync and have,
right.
You know, because they're probably not both going to go out. But I mean, of course, the internet could implode or something, and then we would just devolve into chaos anyway. But I think that another direction to go with this is that there's big free, and then there's big cheap. Okay, and you and I have talked about this. You're really interested in kind of the economic aspect of this. I'm interested in kind of the upside of this, of where the digitization of formerly physical content because of all this new media. I mean, I can remember running a business before the internet, and I can remember paying for tools that now you can get 15 different ones that do it for free. We're kind of spoiled at this sense. You're like, they could just delete my place where I could put stuff that used to be on CDs or VHS tapes for free online. I'm like, yeah, they're letting you have something for free like that. It's like, we've kind of gotten used to it, right? But like, big cheap being like, whether I buy Kindle books for my Kindle. It's like $4.99, $5.99 for like some big, thick, 1,000-page novel or something. And then the less, that's with it all being made out of ones and zeros. But now, I mean, I've got Prime, and shipping's free. It's $80 a year, but it's free once you pay it. And I buy a lot of books, so I don't think twice about buying a book. And I'll look at it, and it's like $7.99. And when the book shows up, the suggested retail price in the back is $17.99. And I'm like, God, they gave it to me for $7.99 or $8.99. It's like, my question is, is that making it hard to make money as an author now? Is it making
Yes, it is.
Right. And so it's made it. And let's look at the ramifications of that. Okay, so anyone can write and publish because we have self-publishing, we have blogs of every way, shape, and form. I mean, good example, over-the-counter podcast. We're paying next to nothing to house this podcast using borderline free tools to make this and promote it.
Right, okay, but let's go back to the whole idea of writers and the economics of this whole thing, and the idea of dumping. I wrote a blog post about this a little while ago, and I just want to explain the concept of dumping, because I think it's such a good metaphor for what's going on here. Mm-hmm. The idea of dumping is that you've got a native industry in a certain country. A big foreign company comes in from another country and starts selling the same product that native industry sells at a much lower price.
Right.
So the native industry is selling it for $25 a widget, and the external company comes in and sells it for $2 a widget. So what happens, of course, is everybody buys the imported product, and the native company goes out of business. Then after the native company goes out of business, the foreign company jacks up the price to $30 or whatever. And so this practice of dumping is illegal.
The pump and dump, they call it.
Right. Yeah. It's illegal under international law, and there are all of these laws in different countries trying to prevent dumping from happening. From having a big American or big Chinese corporation come into a country and dump a bunch of really, really cheap product and cause these economic problems. But to me, it seems like the internet's doing the same thing. And where we see it most clearly is in the writing industry. right? So all of these newspapers have shut down. Publishers have shut down and consolidated. There are tons of writers, copy editors, editors that are all out of work, not because they were doing useless things before, but because Big Free has basically dumped in their part of the economic marketplace.
Yeah, but let me play devil's advocate here. We could be sitting here having this conversation, and I could be going, look, there used to be a filter that only the best ideas got made into books, because you got to have monks that will copy them over and over again in a scriptorium. But now with this newfangled printing press that Gutenberg came up with, anybody can print anything. And now the market's just getting flooded with these books.
Well,
and you never know.
The difference, though, I think, between the transition from writing to printing press and from printing press to internet is that when you went from writing to printing press, people were still paying money to obtain said object. So it's true that a monk copied book might be, let's just say, $30,000, okay? Mm-hmm. And a printing press book might be $100 or $50 or whatever. But when it goes from $100 to free, or $10 to free, then there's no money changing hands. So what's happened, and this is the worst part about it, I think, is that when you go on the internet and you're looking for information about a given topic, 99% of the time, you're going to find all of these trolls publishing all sorts of crappy information that isn't really accurate, isn't really true, that's out there to sort of make money or catch traffic or whatever.
It's a bunch of keywords.
Right? There is tons of so-called information on the internet that really isn't information at all. It's just lousy junk.
But then
it's like junk mail, only worse.
But then that has made room for aggregators to create value by going through all that and then finding, and some of those you have to subscribe to find out certain information, or at least you go, okay, look, if I go to this site, I know, I mean, if I put in best coffee maker in Google, I'm just going to get this tons of stuff, right? But if I see Consumer Reports or Cook's Illustrated, I know, I know who that is. That is someone, and they really do test all these food processors and tell me which one's the best. Or the one that I use a lot, if I'm going to buy, I constantly am losing Bluetooth headsets. About once a year, every 8 months, I have to go drop $50 on a new Bluetooth headset. And I always go to CNET and put in best Bluetooth. And then they have the list, and I go and I look and I read about each one, and I find out.
So,
and,
okay, but
if I just plugged in best Bluetooth,
but again,
into Google, God knows what I'll
You're
find.
Not paying anyone.
No, but
you're not paying anyone anything for that information.
No, I am. I'm giving them my eyeballs, and they have all kinds of ads on that site, and someone must be clicking on it.
Okay, but the difference is, okay, they're going to make 0.5 cents or whatever based on your looking at their website one time, right? Or it's going to be less than 0.5 cents.
Well, they're still doing it, so it must be worthwhile.
Which is different than you paying $4 or $6 for their magazine.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that this is immoral or something, or that we shouldn't use the internet. That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying that the economic realities of information have just totally changed in a way that is, to me right now at least, seems totally chaotic and nonsensical.
I think we're in a transition phase, but I think that information, for the most part, should be something that you can get your hands on. I mean,
for free. Without paying anything to anybody.
I mean, at least some information.
Except your attention span.
Right.
Okay.
When you watch Star Trek, he just says, computer, and he can get all kinds of stuff. Or I carry this little iPhone around, and I jokingly say that this is the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Well, okay, but
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Let me get into that, though, because whether it be in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or in Star Trek, right, In both of those cases, the information is always considered reliable.
Okay? Right.
In the case of the internet and Google, you have no idea whether the information is reliable.
Maybe the computer on board the Enterprise is been programmed to search the internet, filter out all the crap, and give you the real results.
Right. I mean,
we don't know the engine behind it.
Okay, and that is the value of something like Wikipedia, right?
Right.
Where at least there's a... Many of the articles are very reliable, right? And people have been working to source everything and whatever else. And that's a great service, right? And it's free.
Right.
But they're having trouble, right? They keep fundraising and having trouble fundraising enough money to keep the project going because it's big free again, right? So nobody's going to buy the Encyclopedia Britannica. Nobody's going to buy the Funkin' Wagnalls Encyclopedia or whatever. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that they should, right? But at least those were viable economic models. Wikipedia is not.
But I guess part of me thinks that what's going to happen is, I mean, right now, I don't understand how this works, but evidently there isn't, exactly speaking, one internet. I mean, you see www2, www3, but I know that has to do with different ways in which, but maybe there'll become a time when there is different sections of the internet, so to speak, and maybe there's a gate, maybe there's a barrier, and maybe someone has done the work of keeping out all the crap. You know, like a good example, I have, if Apple wants to send me something free, I'm advertising for you today. I just bought Apple TV about 6 months ago, right? And there's a bunch of apps on there, and someone has looked at this app and decided that these people have content that is worth putting up there. There's a million places you go find YouTube videos, but YouTube and Vimeo and these places are ones that we know. They're not going to, you know, they've narrowed it down. I think aggregation has a value. When there's too many choices, when there's an infinite number of choices, someone who could cut those choices down for you based on some kind of knowledge creates a value.
Yeah, but see, to me,
and I think like, monetary dollar on that.
It's the difference between having one teacher to 15 students in a class and one teacher to 1,500 students in a class.
Right. Let's talk about MOOCs. Yeah.
Okay, well, there are three things I want to get to. MOOCs is one. Linotype's another. But I also want to touch on the micropayment system. So you mentioned the idea of a gate, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of commentators have suggested that what should happen with the internet is the development of a micropayment system. So you click on a link from Google to go to an article at the Chicago Tribune on a topic you're interested in. You get to the Chicago Tribune website and it says, do you want to make a micropayment of 1 cent to read this article? And you click yes to read it or no to kick you back to Google. It's an interesting idea. I think the problem with it right now is just the technology, right? They didn't set up this kind of micropayment system 15 years ago, and so implementing it right now would be really tough, and there would be lots of people that would just opt out and would just say, I am never going to pay 1 cent.
Right now, it drives me nuts because it's either or. I'll be doing some research on something, and a lot of the articles, because of the location of what I'm researching, will take you back to, say, The Guardian or something like that.
Right.
And every once in a while, I'll hit a wall and it says you've read the amount of free articles you can read for the month. You now need to subscribe. Some random paper in England. You're the ones who did a bunch of stories on something I'm working on, but I've kind of got enough information. But I would probably keep going if I could pay a nickel.
Another great example of this, you know, I look up academic papers when I'm doing scholarly research. And there are a lot of these, you know, a lot of them are online. They have been for a while, and that's great. But if you don't have free access to them through your institution or whatever, to get one article will often cost $38.
Yeah.
Is crazy.
I've ran into that.
That's an incredible amount of money for like 10 or 20 pages of content. Really?
Right.
$38? Like, there are plenty of books I could buy for that amount of money. And it's a lot cheaper to just go to the library and look up the article that I need. So I don't know. I think, but if it was 5 cents, I would probably pay for it.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if it was 50 cents or a dollar, I would probably pay for it. That would save me a trip to the library.
Right. You're going to burn more in gas and time.
Right. Okay. So there are a couple other things we need to talk about. Linotype is one. This is really fascinating. So we talked about the technological transition from monks writing books to the printing press, from the printing press to the computerized world. But one of the ones we didn't talk about is from handset type to linotype. Mm-hmm. And it used to be, this is about 1880s, right, that all type was set by hand, whether for a book, newspaper, whatever else. It was all set by hand. Every single letter was picked up by a person, mm-hmm. right, and put into a row. Every single letter. Then a brilliant guy invented the linotype machine. I can't remember what his name is. Which basically allowed a whole line of type to be set using a keyboard. So you'd have somebody sitting at a keyboard. They would be typing in all the letters that would go into that line. They would fall into place, and it would actually shoot out a lead cast of all the type in that one line of type. Mm-hmm. And so at the time that that technology came out onto the market, people were really concerned that all of these folks that had been setting type by hand were going to lose their jobs. And they did, right? There were all of these print shops where all these people who had set type by hand for their whole lives lost their jobs. But what happened was there was an explosion of publishing because Linotype made it so much faster to publish that all of those former people that were setting type by hand now got jobs as Linotype operators. Okay, so to me, this is really similar to what's happened with the internet, right? Is that you have traditional publishers shutting down the publication of and you have the mass growth of information production with the internet, okay, and computers. And what should seem to be happening is writers, editors, copy editors, all those people seems like those people should go from traditional print publication jobs to jobs working for internet publications. But that actually hasn't been happening, right? The number of writers, copy editors has declined and declined and declined over the past 10, 20 years. So why is that happening? Why isn't that transition taking place? How come the economic realities aren't making that happen?
Well, partially because the more casual nature of reading information, because of all the devices we read on and where everyone's writing blogs and text messages and all the stuff that we have come to, we've lowered our expectation on the level of editing and kind of polish and accuracy,
right,
and just imparting information. I don't know how many times I'm reading a news story off of Drudge Report or something, LinkedIn, and the same paragraph will be back to back. Does someone accidentally cut and paste the same paragraph two times in a row and no one caught it?
Right, because there's no copy editor.
There's no copy editor, right? Now, what's interesting, though, is that it's funny. You brought this Linotype thing up, and I had heard a different version of the story, and I want to look more deeply into it, about the Typesetters Union. And this might just be in different locations that happen different ways, because in some places, the Typesetters Union had lifelong contracts. And part of their contract was they didn't have to learn a new skill. And the movement from typeset printing, maybe this was the movement from Linotype to that new thing. Because newspapers for a long time were printed on these big metal cylinders that they would etch in there, and then it would roll across. There was no typeset at all, Linotype or otherwise. It was these etched cylinders that they would roll off, and it wasn't printed anymore. And that transition happened, and the Typesetters Union had lifelong contracts. And so there were places in America where a guy in his late 20s had gotten one of the last jobs in the Typesetters Union, and they spent their life coming into a newspaper, clocking in, going into a room with Typesetters Union on the door, and just playing cards and reading the newspaper and hanging out all day, because they...
See, that doesn't seem like a useful...
They weren't allowed to go learn. It would be weakening to the union to make... if they've opted to go learn a new skill and go work. But it was so much cheaper to print their papers this way that they decided to just keep paying the salaries of the typesetters to do nothing. And
it's crazy.
Now the process has changed. I remember being in high school and going and visiting the Daily Journal in Flat River, Missouri, and they showed how they would take this copy and you'd cut it with an X-Acto knife and paste it up, and you'd mock up an article with like this X-Acto knife and stuff. But then that would go over and it would get etched onto some kind of a big old cylinder,
yeah,
for each page.
Yeah, that's post Linotype technology,
right?
Yeah.
And so when that transition happened, right. And so now they don't do, obviously, anything like that. I mean, Now it's all done on computer and just shot out of a printer. So
I think we're going to have to save MOOCs for another time, Andrew.
Come on, we could do a couple minutes on MOOCs.
We could do a whole 25 minutes on massively open online courses with MOOCs. And I think it would be really helpful. So these are our thoughts.
The digitization of education could be like an entire...
Oh, yeah. We could talk about that for hours. Okay. So these are our thoughts so far on Big Free. We're not really sure what's going to happen with it or where it's going to go or whether it's going to be good or evil or whether we'll all be, I don't know.
I'm positive.
Serfs of the Google's on Overlord or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, this is the over-the-counter podcast.
I, for one, welcome our Google Zon overlords.
This is the over-the-counter podcast, episode number 5. Signing off, this is Mark Eastcheck, and
I'm Andrew Whaley.
See you next time.